Come, boys. You'll be late for work.
We're coming. Good morning, Mother Peep.
Good morning, Ollie.
When you come on, it's almost 8 o'clock. You upstairs in the bedroom.
You did.
Well, how'd you get down here?
I fell out the window. Good morning, Mother Peep.
Good morning, Sammy.
Good morning, Ollie.
Good morning, Stan. Never mind good morning. Come on and let's go.
Hello, hello, and a very warm welcome to this extra special bonus edition of the Laurel and Hardy podcast. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Vasey, and today we are celebrating the latest book release from our good friend, Randy Skretvedt, March of the Wooden Soldiers, the amazing story of Laurel and Hardy's Babes in Toyland. It was published through Bonaventure Press a few weeks ago at the end of 2023, just in time for the holidays. And to keep to the spirit of the season, I wanted to make sure this episode was released before the end of Christmas, so before Twelfth Night, and we've done it, just. But it doesn't matter when you're listening to this, as chatting with Randy about anything related to Laurel and Hardy is always entertaining and informative, as I'm sure you know by now. Now, I'd invited Randy on to chat about the book on the podcast, but we weren't sure when we'd be able to both fit it in before Christmas. But as luck would have it, we realised we had a slot the very next day, so we jumped at the chance. And as it was Christmas, I thought it would be a nice idea to invite the patrons of the podcast to join us on Zoom and watch the live recording. And even though it was very last minute, we had a great turnout of around a dozen or so patrons, some with cameras and microphones and many without, but who were able to sit in and watch the episode unfold. And I think it went really, really well. We had a question and answer session at the end, so the patrons were able to join in. And I think a good and slightly festive time was had by all. I certainly aim to do more of these going forward and will make sure to give everyone more notice next time. But circumstances just didn't allow for that this time around. Now, if you'd like to be a part of the next podcast live event, then all you need to do is to join us at patreon.com, patreon.com. You will need to be signed up to the Plumtree tier if you want the live sessions, the Q&A opportunities, etc. But if you're only after more episodes to listen to, then you can always choose the other option called the Lower Elements. So do check out the page at patreon.com or click the link in the show notes or on the laurelandhardyfilms.com website. And speaking of patrons, we've had a huge influx of new people join us since the last episode, so big thank yous and welcomes go to Fred Velez, Kevin Kuzinitz, Terry Berman, Frank Holman, Chris Sagan, Stephen O'Neill, Mark Robertson, Chris Shear, Peter Hillman, Ryan Barrett, Jim Michieli, Andrew Center, Michael Eastham, Lorenzo De Luca, and Scott Leslie. So thank you again, all of you, for joining and supporting me in this podcasting odyssey. And by the looks of your comments, you're enjoying the extra podcasts and the magazines already, so that's fantastic. Okay, so let's not dilly-dally any further, as we've got to outsmart a sizable rodent. And as you know, big bait catches big rat. Joining us for today's special bonus episode of the Laurel and Hardy podcast is our good friend, Randy Skretvedt. Welcome back to the podcast, Randy.
Thank you for the opportunity, Patrick, and Merry Yuletide to you and to everybody who is listening and participating.
Absolutely, and Merry Yuletide to yourself as well. And I should say, for anybody listening on the main podcast, we do have some patrons with us for tonight's recording. So we will hopefully open for a question and answer session at the end. So if you have any questions throughout, guys, please do make a note, and then you can ask them to Randy at the end of the show. So, Randy, today we are here to talk about not about a film. Yes, we are here to talk about a film, but we're actually here to talk about a book of a film, which is your brand new book. I have it here in hardback. March of the Wooden Soldiers, the amazing story of Laurel and Hardy's Babes in Toyland.
I, as of an hour ago, am the happy owner of a hardcover copy as well. It just showed up in the mail about an hour and a half ago. So I'm thrilled that both editions now do exist, and I hope they are being flung hither and yon to everybody who has ordered one already.
I say it's a wonderful book. From what I've seen so far, it is a wonderful book, and I've no doubt my opinion is not going to change. I have had to wrestle this off Santa Claus, because this was put away. This was in the stocking waiting for me. It was a big stocking. When we decided we were going to do this, I thought, I've got to have a little look at this. And it is wonderful, as we knew it would be. So what I'd love to do is to just have a little chat about the book. It's thrown me slightly because obviously I like to keep the chronology of the podcast in chronological order. And this is throwing us a little bit way into the future, or a good few years into the future anyway. But what the hell? It's Christmas, so we'll do it anyway. So I'm interested, unless you can correct me, Randy, I think this book on Atoll K is the only other book specifically about one film. Is that right?
Well, Danny Lawrence has done one which is largely about Duck Soup.
Good point.
So there's that.
Yes.
There's that one as well. So we have essentially the first and last Laurel and Hardy films individually documented. I do have scripts for, let's see, I've got Fra Diavolo, which is a huge script. It's like 400 pages, about the size of an old telephone book, if you remember those. I have Saps at Sea, Chump at Oxford, Swiss Miss, which has the full lyric for the Cheese Shop musical number that got cut. I have several, Bohemian Girl, I have several scripts for features, so there's always a possibility that perhaps we might do books based on those scripts with other production information. So there is material yet to be mined. But I thought that Babes in Toyland, or as it is more commonly known, at least in the States, March of the Wooden Soldiers, I thought that was a special case because, for one thing, it has a very, very interesting history, not only in the original production, but also in the origin of the story and subsequent productions, and also in what happened to the film after it was released and after the rights went to the Victor Herbert estate. There's a whole tangled web of different licensees over the years. So that's another interesting part of the story. And it is particularly held in high regard by people in New York City because for the past 60 years, not quite every year, but most of those 60 years, it's been run at Thanksgiving time in late November and on Christmas Day or near it by a television station called WPIX in New York City. And for people who grew up in New York City, this is the official kickoff of the holiday season for them. So, that's not really the case in other parts of the country, even though it might be shown during that time of the year. But it is a real event in New York City. And I thought, well, that's a different audience from somebody who would buy Laurel and Hardy, The Magic Behind the Movies. You know, it's a different audience from the Sons of the Desert crowd. They know this movie specifically. They might not know other Laurel and Hardy movies. They might not know the background of Laurel and Hardy or how their films were made. And I thought, well, you know, this film has a particularly interesting story in the production, and it has a particular audience which really ought to be acknowledged. And so that's why I thought it's time to write a book specifically about Babes in Toyland. Also because it was just such an unusual film for Roach to make and such a courageous one to make because it was really the most elaborate fantasy film made in Hollywood up until the time of The Wizard of Oz 5 years later at MGM. And so for a comparatively little studio like Hal Roach's to make a film on this scale, particularly at a time when short subjects were starting to be phased out in favor of double features, and his studio was sort of really at a crossroads. This was a courageous step for Roach to take. So there's a lot of drama in the in the story of the production of Babes in Toyland. It had a particularly interesting story. Also, many years ago, back in 1980 and 81, I was able to do extensive interviews with not only Hal Roach, but also with Felix Knight, who played Tom Tom, and Henry Brandon, who played Barnaby. Terrific interview. I mean, he had such a full, precise memory of everything. And so he is quoted at length in the book, because he was really our best eyewitness for all of it. And so, you know, having that material as well, and also the complete original script was available online and still is. So that was there. So there were all these elements that said, do a book, write a book about this film specifically.
So how did you find, I mean, obviously, I'm guessing your writing method is it the same, the way that you research the book as compared to a chapter in The Magic Behind the Movies? Did you find any more resources to draw from because you're trying to take an even deeper dive? I mean, how was that experience for you?
Oh, yeah. Well, way back in 1979, when we were still using file cards and cassette tapes, and there was no such thing as the internet, I did go through the 1930s, 1934 specifically, payroll ledgers at USC, University of Southern California. And I'm glad I did, because right now they're evidently not available. They need to be recategorized or something. I tried to get access to them again and couldn't. So happily, I had made very detailed notes on who was on the payroll at the time that Babes in Toyland was being made. I wanted to find expressly who was the guy who designed the sets, because there's no credit, even though those sets are amazing, there's no credit for art direction or set design. And I think I got the right person. There was someone named C.E. Christensen, who was a longtime employee, and he seemed to be the guy who was overseeing the design and construction of the sets. I do know that another guy by the name of Slim Gregg, who was a longtime carpenter at the Roach Studios and who did some very intricate work. In fact, he used to build model replicas of ships, and you can see one on the mantle, the fireplace mantle in Hogwild. And, you know, these beautiful tall ships in miniature. And when people at the Roach Studios found out that he made them, everybody wanted one. He said, well, you know, I can't make these overnight, you know, so it takes several months to make one. But I know he was part of the construction crew. So I tried to name everybody as much as I could. So I had sources from long ago, from over 40 years ago. I still have all the file cards from long ago. And of course, now we have this wonderful thing called the Lantern Media History Digital Project, which is put together by the University of Wisconsin at Madison. And the great thing about that is I don't have to drive to Beverly Hills to the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Library 4 days a week, as I did back then, and pull gigantic volumes of old trade papers with no index and just hope to find something about Laurel and Hardy, which is what I did years ago. Now you just type into a search engine and 10,000 articles appear magically before you, and you can do your research in your pajamas. So, which I'm sad to say I actually have done many times.
Yes, me too.
So that's another reason to write this book, is that there was so much more material which continues to keep flowing. There's, you know, there's more and more and more that keeps being revealed to us. Having that new source of really day by day production information, you know, that was a terrific boon to me to have all of this. And there are sections of the book where I really do go day by day, particularly with regard to an injury that Stan suffered at one point during the filming. It was really his progress or lack of it in healing was noted by all the trade papers on almost a daily basis. And so I have that very minutely chronicled in the book. But this was, you know, this not only was this a very courageous production for Roach to undertake, but it also at one point seemed to be cursed, because there were so many setbacks that were preventing it from being filmed. And in fact, there were at least two attempts by the same producer to make other films of Babes in Toyland, neither of which ever came to fruition. So this book, it not only covers the Hal Roach film, although obviously that is the primary emphasis, but in order to have the full story of Babes in Toyland, you have to go back to the original production, which goes back to 1903. And the reason that Babes in Toyland was ever produced on the stage in 1903 was because the year before there had been a major hit musical of The Wizard of Oz. So we have Dorothy and the Tin Man and the Scarecrow and the Cowardly Lion to thank for Babes in Toyland ever coming into being. The reason The Wizard of Oz got published was only because the new manager of the Chicago Opera House agreed to produce a musical, a stage musical, to promote the book. So the book would promote the musical and the musical would promote the book, because nobody had any faith in L. Frank Baum. And because the musical was a hit, the book took off and sold out its first printing almost immediately and the second printing almost immediately. And really, it was the success of the stage musical that triggered the success of the book. And so that show in 1902 went from Chicago to Broadway. Well, after it had gone to Broadway, the people who ran the Chicago theater said, we want another show just like Wizard of Oz that will be an equal success. And they got the same production crew, the same guy writing the book, who was Glenn McDonough, and he wrote the book and the lyrics. And they said, well, who can we get to write the music? Well, Victor Herbert was a renowned composer and had written many musicals for the stage, but he hadn't done one for 7, 8, or 8 years. And because they had all the ingredients for what looked to be a surefire hit show, they went to him and said, would you consider writing the music? And so he was enticed and he came onto the project. And when you look at the original libretto, now this is something I didn't have way back when I did the original Magic Behind the Movies. I was sort of taking Hal Roach at his word, because I think he actually saw it as a boy. He would have been 11 years old when it was produced in New York, and he was from Elmira, New York, so there's a possibility he might have seen it, or maybe a road company, because it continued to be produced on the road until 1906. But he said it had no real storyline. It was just a bunch of unrelated sketches, and they had all these beautiful costumes and lights and everything else. And he said, that's why I had to write a story for it. Well, it does have a story, but it also does meander into many other side roads, that so many of them that the main thrust of the storyline kind of gets lost and confused. The other problem with the 1903 libretto is that it's very gory.
Yes.
When I read it, I said, this cannot be Babes in Toyland. Are you kidding? The opening scene is a shipwreck where the two babes, Alan and Jane, are supposed to be killed by nasty Uncle Barnaby, who wants to get their inheritance. Alan and Jane are orphans, and they have been left a lot of money. And Barnaby wants to get the money because he wants to marry Mary quite contrary. And he thinks if he has lots of money, he'll win her favor. So the opening is the kids almost drowned, almost killed in a shipwreck. Well, they are rescued by some gypsies on an island who then send them back to Toyland. Well, then Barnaby wants to poison the kids. And he's in cahoots with the evil toy maker, who looks at first like he loves children, but actually is making these toys that are designed to rise up and stab the children on Christmas Day when they open the boxes. They're little miniature murderers with daggers, and they're supposed to stab the kids to death. Well, as it turns out, maybe the toys have a conscience, because they wind up stabbing the toy maker. They turn on him, and they send him. They set his toy shop on fire, and they send him running into God knows where this came from in Toyland, but there's a volcano. And he runs in terror up to the top of the volcano. Maybe not the wisest choice to make, but that's what he does. And he plunges to his fiery demise in this volcano. And then later on, Alan is put on trial for killing the toy maker, which he didn't do. It's just Barnaby putting him up for that, because Barnaby's a nasty guy. And Alan is almost beheaded, almost executed by the guillotine. But that happily is stopped at the last minute, because Barnaby accidentally drinks poison, which he intended for Jane. So we have attempted drownings and poisonings and stabbings and death by volcano and almost a decapitation set to the lovely lilting melodies of Victor Herbert. Yeah. So you just go, well, you can't do this story, particularly in 1934, because that's the year when the production code came in. I'm sure you are well aware of pre-code movies. That's a big deal in old movie circles. films made around 1930 to the middle of 1934. You know, during the Depression, the movie studios were trying to do anything to get people to spend their precious dimes and quarters at the movie theater. And so they were making movies that were ever more controversial and salacious. And some of those movies are rather shocking even today. But that's when the code came in and said, you can't do that anymore. And that was right at the time that Babes in Toyland was being produced. And, you know, Roach wrote an original story for it. He made the deal with RKO. That's another story. That's one of the films that didn't get produced. A man named William LeBaron was an executive at RKO. He had worked with Victor Herbert in 1917. They had collaborated on a Broadway show together. And LeBaron always had a very high regard for Victor Herbert and his music. Herbert died in 1924, but his daughter, Ella, was now the executrix of Victor Herbert's estate, and she was a very tough businesswoman, and she turned Herbert's rather modest personal estate into a multi-million dollar fortune by knowing how to license all of his music and all of his shows, and she had a tight fist around everything. Well, she made a deal with William LeBaron and RKO, which was a brand new studio at that point, 1930, and they were going to make a lavish, part Technicolor, Babes in Toyland. It was going to star the comedy team of Wheeler and Woolsey, who had made a couple of films for RKO. They were presumably going to be Barnaby's henchmen, who are called Gregorio and Rodrigo. And that may be where they got the idea for the Laurel and Hardy characters, although they're never Barnaby's henchmen in the 1934 movie. But RKO was going to make this very lavish film. They bought the rights, the filming rights, for $50,000 in 1930 dollars. But they had another musical called Dixie Anna, and that was also very lavish and very expensive and part Technicolor, two-color Technicolor. And unfortunately, it lost $300,000 because it wasn't very good. It was very lavish, but it wasn't very good. And the public had really grown tired of musicals very quickly because you have to realize that's the only kind of movie that was not made during the silent era. Was musicals, even though there were some silent films based on the storylines of Broadway musicals, but obviously they didn't have the songs in them. There had been 63 musicals released in 1929 and a further 63 in 1930. That's more than one a week. And people were finally going, enough with the musicals already. We don't need musicals. Stop, stop, stop. And so RKO said, well, I guess people don't want us to spend a huge sum on a lavish Babes in Toyland. So they put it on the shelf. So they did nothing with it for 3 years. And then they thought, maybe we could make an animated cartoon out of this expensive property that we're not doing anything with. So they contacted Walt Disney. They said, how much would it cost to make a feature length cartoon of Babes in Toyland? This is several years before Snow White. This is 1933. And Disney gave them a cost estimate. And they said, well, that's still too expensive. Thank you very much. But Walt Disney and Hal Roach were polo buddies. They were both members of something called the Uplifters Club in Pacific Palisades, California, which was a gentleman's sporting club. And Hal Roach had a string of polo ponies there. And he and Disney played polo together. Well, Disney told Roach that RKO had this property, Babes in Toyland, and they weren't doing anything with it. And maybe they would be amenable to selling him the rights. And Roach had just come off of Fra Diavolo, or Devil's Brother, which was a gigantic success. And he was looking for another operetta to put Laurel and Hardy in. And he thought, well, Babes in Toyland will even be another success because it'll be great for kids. And kids were always a key part of Laurel and Hardy's audience. So he went to New York, the brand new, beautiful RKO building, and he made a deal with the RKO executives. He bought it for $50,000, which is what they paid for it. And instead of flying back, which he normally would have done because he was such an aviation enthusiast, he took the 4 days on the train from New York to L.A. to write a story. Well, he wrote this story and he said, I thought Stan was going to go nuts over it. And it's a very unusual story. It's not the same story as the 1903 original, but in a way, it's just as grim. you wonder where the comedy and where the music fits in. I will leave the details of it to readers because it's rather complicated. But in fairness to Mr. Roach, and we must remember that he did come up with many of the storylines for the Laurel and Hardy shorts that we love. And he was always a very hands-on producer. He always saw the dailies every day. And he was very much a collaborator with Stan Laurel in making the finished film. So we can't besmirch his reputation. After all, Laurel and Hardy would not have existed had it not been for Hal Roach and his studio. You know, Laurel and Hardy, unlike other comedy teams, did not come to movies with many years together in vaudeville. They came together at the studio. And you can see, if you look at the year one Blu-ray, you can see that team coming together in fits and starts all through those films. So anyway, Mr. Roach wrote this story. He gave it to Stan. Stan read it and didn't like it. And Roach told me that the Stan's stated reason was, oh, well, we're not wearing the derby hats. We can't be funny without the derby hats. Now, that's very curious because Laurel and Hardy had already made many films where they don't wear the derby hats. So unless Stan was grasping at straws to just avoid telling his boss, this is terrible, that's the only thing I can think of. But in any event, they argued about it. And finally, Roach told me, I said, I'm out of the thing completely. Go make the picture. And I never paid a bloody bit of attention to what they did. Well, that's not true, because if you go through the trade papers, you find that Roach was intimately involved in every aspect of the production, and which included hiring the two new guys who rewrote the story, who were Frank Butler, who had been at the studio before in the 20s as an actor and a writer. And Frank Butler hired a guy named Nick Grinday. And the two of them wrote the basic story of what we know today as Babes in Toyland. And their script exists. It does not have much material for Laurel and Hardy in it. There's a whole bunch, many times throughout the screen, script, it will say Laurel and Hardy routine to be added here by the Laurel and Hardy Company. So obviously Stan and Charlie Rogers and whoever the other gag men were at the time, they were concentrating on writing the Laurel and Hardy material. But the basic storyline that we know today was put together by Frank Butler and Nick Grinday, who had been hired by Roach. And again, Roach is the guy who decided that having two units, two different directors, one for the straight footage and one for the Laurel and Hardy footage, would expedite production. And he hired the whoever it was who designed the sets, and hired many, many extra carpenters and plasterers and painters who were working on 4 6-hour shifts. So they had a 24-hour production going on the construction of the sets. And, you know, he was involved in he hired the musical director, Harry Jackson. Harry Jackson was a prominent band leader in Los Angeles at society functions and also on local radio. And he had played the music at the Hal Roach 20th anniversary party in December of 1933, which is right after Roach had bought the rights to Babes in Toyland. And they needed a bigger orchestra for Babes in Toyland than what they had had doing the background music from Leroy Scheel and from the shorts. And so that's why Harry Jackson was hired for it, because Hal Roach liked his music at the anniversary party. And Hal Roach did the casting for Tom Tom. There were several people who were considered for Tom Tom. And he auditioned Felix Knight, because Felix Knight was appearing at Grauman's Chinese Theater in a live prologue before the movie. Roach also found Henry Brandon, or Henry Kleinbach, as he was known. Henry was appearing in a play called The Drunkard. There was a dinner theater in Los Angeles called the Theater Mart. And you could have, with the new repeal of Prohibition, you could have a glass of beer, which was a wonderful new thing in late 1933, early 34. All these people had been thirsting for beer for 14 years with the advent of Prohibition. And as Henry told me, he said, well, it was the first place where you could have a glass of beer and you could hiss the villain and cheer the hero and make a fool of yourself and have a great time. And he said the producers of this show were planning to do many other shows, but The Drunkard became such a hit that it ran for 26 and a half years. And Henry was with it for a year and a half. And Roach saw him playing the evil villain Squire Cribbs. And so Hal Roach is the guy who hired Henry Kleinbach to be Silas Barnaby. So, as I say, Roach was involved in all of it. He never did wash his hands of the thing entirely. And even to the point of when the film was finished, He hand-delivered the first print of it to the executives of Lowe's Incorporated, which was the parent company of MGM. They were in New York. He flew his plane to New York, which he also called Babes in Toyland. He christened his plane Babes in Toyland and delivered the print to Arthur Lowe and probably Fred Quimby and other people at MGM. So it was Hal Roach's film more than anybody else's, and that's why it's such a shame that in his later years he disparaged this film so much, even more so than Ella Herbert Bartlett, Victor Herbert's daughter. I interviewed Hal Roach twice in 1981, and once in January and once in February. He had just turned 89 years old in January, and before I could even ask my first question, he launched into this rather bitter story about why I let Laurel and Hardy go was because of Babes in Toyland. And he said, at that point, it was no longer any fun or anything else to me. And, you know, I told them that I was through. Well, they weren't through. They worked for another 5 years together. but the fact that he remembered this as being the break, the end of their relationship, I think was significant. But anyway, it was a very traumatic thing for Roach, because as I say, not only was it sort of a make or break film with the decline in first of all, a lot of theaters were closing during the Depression, and a lot of theaters were getting rid of short subjects to put in a second feature, a B movie, instead of short subjects. So there was that problem. And then specific to Hal Roach, he was the only live action producer who had films distributed by MGM. Ub Iwerks was making cartoons for MGM. And later on, there were the Fitzpatrick Travel Talks, the shorts made for MGM. But MGM, really, the only guy who was making features that MGM distributed was Hal Roach. And MGM wanted his features to be on a level of what MGM was making, which of course was, they were the most lavish films being made in Hollywood. So Roach really wanted this film to show the MGM executives, look, I can make something on a level that MGM makes. And so in a way it was sort of a make or break film for him. So all of the production problems that were incurred, I'm sure added to his level of anxiety tremendously over the year, really, that it took from the time that he made the deal to buy the film rights to the time that the film was released. It was really a solid year from November 33 to November of 34.
Well, that kind of makes a lot of sense if you think that, you know, he's bought the rights to it, and he's potentially, you know, if you've seen it as a child, it's probably a special story to him, unless it scarred him for life, but it didn't sound like it did.
Evidently, the kids who saw it then loved it, and the reviewer for the New York Times said, children will love this, and it's wonderful, wholesome fun, and the kids will drag their parents to see it a second time. So,
I suppose if you think of the old British pantomimes and even the Punch and Judy shows, you know, there's quite a bit of dark stuff going on in those, you know. And if you write down what the action is, you can kind of think to yourself, my God, that's a bit strong.
Grimm's fairy tales are grim indeed.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But I mean, yeah, you know, as far as Roach is concerned, as you say, he's obviously got a lot tied up in the production of it. He's got a lot of stress and anxiety to make sure that it is what he wants it to be. Mm-hmm. Stan's, I mean, understandably for Stan, he's very protective of the Stan and Ollie characters and doesn't want to go down that kind of road.
Right. Yeah, in Roach's story, they were Barnaby's henchmen.
Yeah, exactly.
As Roderigo and Gonzorgo had been in the stage play.
Yeah, right. Okay, gotcha. And also, I mean, that's very similar to the Rogue Song, I guess, as well, because they were henchmen of the bad guy in that, weren't they?
The Bandit.
Yeah,
they were part of the Bandit gang. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But yeah, so you could sort of see that if Roach has got a memory of that production built around his anxiety levels, that he's got to make sure this is right and good and proper, and then Stan's putting a spanner in the works. It's probably kind of, that kind of makes a bit more sense now.
Well, and Stan put the spanner in the works a couple of times, one of which was entirely preventable. He had gotten divorced from Lois in October of 33, and he had rather hastily made this deal whereby she would get 50% of his earnings right off the top in perpetuity. And he realized Just as all of this was happening with Roach buying the rights to Babes in Toyland, he realized, hey, wait a minute. Maybe I shouldn't have given away quite so much. And he tried to get her to reduce the amount of alimony, and she would not budge. And so he said, well, fine, then I'm not going to work. You're not going to get a penny because I'm not going to make anything. Well, Roach didn't need that to happen. He needed Stan to be there at the studio to work on this film. And so that was, oh, gosh, a good month, you know, taken out of the production. And by that time, they were already well along with making orchestrations and casting other roles and putting the sets together. And, you know, you have Stan all of a sudden saying, because I don't want to pay all this alimony, I've decided that I'm having health problems. Well, you know, that was all during March and April of 34. And then he married Ruth out of the blue, which took everybody by surprise. And I guess he decided that because he had a new wife, maybe half an income was better than none. And I think Roach actually very generously boosted his salary to the point where Stan was almost taking home as much as he had been prior to the divorce with Lois. So thanks, Hal. So now Stan was making $3,500 a week now. So, which is an amazing sum in 1934 dollars, by the way.
There must have been some quite interesting conversations going between Stan, Hal Roach, and Lois, because Lois and Hal Roach, obviously, they had quite a lot of dialogue, didn't they? Because she was sort of his agent, for want of a better word, for a while, or manager.
They remained good friends until she passed away, which was in the 1990s, or in the late 1980s, I guess. Anyway, as long as they were both alive, they were both good friends. And Lois took Stan's money and made a lot of money to the point where she never really needed what Stan was giving to her. He needed the money a lot more than she did, but I think she still managed to to still get whatever he was making even into his years of retirement. So what can you say? So be never get married, as Mr. Hardy says. or at least never get divorced or have a better attorney than Ben Shipman, than what Stan had. You don't agree to that deal.
Or don't have a long-term affair with another actress in the meantime.
Yes, well,
because that might have soured things for us slightly.
You are upset, aren't you?
Upset? I'm housebroken.
Not housebroken. He means heartbroken. Housebroken.
You touched on it a little bit previously about Laurel and Hardy always being big with or popular with children. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered whether or not this film has any kind of responsibility for Laurel and Hardy's kind of association as child's entertainers. Because, you know, sometimes when you mention Laurel and Hardy, they're grouped into children's films nowadays.
Yeah, well, I find it a bit strange. It was very much promoted as a children's film, and the reviewers of the time, as you will see when you read some of the reviews, they were saying, you know, parents and PTA organizations, school organizations have been decrying the fact that there aren't any suitable films for kids. Well, here's finally one that doesn't play down to them and that kids will actually enjoy, and at least this Christmas you won't have the complaint of there being nothing for the kids to see at the movie theater, which had been a problem for the preceding two or three years with all of those pre-code movies coming in all the time. That was very much adult film fare. There wasn't a lot for the kids to see in those days. Babes in Toyland was welcomed as a film for the children, which was, by the way, another stress inducer for Hal Roach, because children's admission fees were much lower than what the adults paid. So filling up those seats at half price. So you hope that you can get all those kids to come at least twice and make up the difference.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it surprised me because I used to think the bogeymen were horrible. They used to terrify the hell out of me when I was a kid.
Oh, really? Well, see, the first movies I fell in love with before I ever saw Laurel and Hardy were Frankenstein and The Wolfman and Dracula, all of the Universal 1930s monster movies, which never scared me. I thought they were just sort of creepy fun, you know, because you never saw anything gory, really. But yes, the bogeyman, yet another stress inducer for Hal Roach, that was the point of concern. with the censorship board, the newly installed Production Code Administration, which kicked in on July 1st of 1934, just as we were really going into full production phase on Babes in Toyland. There is a lot of correspondence between the Production Code Administration people and the Hal Roach Studios, which survives at the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences Library. And happily, I was able to go through all of it and quote it. And so, you know, their precise concerns are enumerated, and mainly it was about the bogeymen. And when they were worried about it when it was just in script form, and when the final cut was submitted to the PCA to see if it would get the seal of approval, they gave it sort of a qualified approval. They said, you know, well, yes, this is fine for kids. We would, however, suggest that you trim the bogeymen scenes to an absolute minimum, because they're probably going to be rather worrisome to excitable children. But we will give you, I think it was number 401 was the production code number that it got. So it did qualify for a approval code, but with reservations. And, you know, in those days, a film not only had to pass that censor board, but there were individual state censor boards as well. And so they weighed in on whether or not it was approved for Ohio or Michigan or whatever state it happened to be. Most states thought it was fine without any problems. But there were a few states that said, trim 4 shots of the bogeymen from reel 8 and trim these shots from reel 9. In foreign countries, Sweden said, please eliminate all shots of the bogeymen. Well, I don't know how you have the ending of the film without the bogeyman.
Yeah, exactly.
And then there was Latvia. Evidently, Latvia was very strict in censorship, and they just would not run the film at all. And in fact, there had been several Laurel and Hardy shorts, which they thought were not suitable for general audiences or any audiences. So they were not admitted in Latvia. So it's interesting how these people reacted around the world. In England, there were a couple of critics who said, you know, isn't it possible to have films like this for children without these upsetting bogeymen? You know, but you have to have dramatic conflict somehow. You have to have something. You can't just have everything be sweetness and light for 90 minutes and that's the end of the film. And then I found a wonderful letter in a movie fan magazine, a lady from Minnesota. And she said, hooray for Laurel and Hardy. We finally took our son, little Bill, age 7, to his first movie. And he was just enchanted. He loved all the Toyland characters that he knew from children's books and fairy tales. And he loved the bogeymen. And all the kids in the audience loved the bogeymen. And they cheered when the soldiers came in and vanquished the bogeymen and saved Toyland. And so thank you, Laurel and Hardy and Hal Roach, for making this wonderful film for children. So I think, as maybe is true of the kids of 1903 who saw that gory stage production, maybe kids actually were more interested and more forgiving or more enthused about seeing the bogeymen than their nervous parents and other associations might have thought in those days. So
yeah, absolutely.
So it didn't seem to upset the kids. It certainly didn't upset the kids who worked on that sequence. Because we have firsthand accounts from Jerry Tucker and Dickie Jones and Gene Reynolds, who became a producer in television. They were all in the bogeyman sequences, and they said, "Oh no, we had a great time running around and screaming. You know, it was fun. You know, so not only did they have a good time, but strangely enough, so did." Payne Johnson, who is still with us. He's 93, I believe. He lives in San Diego, and he was one of the three little pigs. He says, I was the smart pig. I was the one who had the brick house. And he told me, he said, there were about 40 kids auditioning for the parts of the three little pigs. And at the audition, they put on this big rubber head that I had to wear, and they put rubber claws. And then we had to be fat, so they put us in these padded costumes, and you can imagine all the hot lights that they needed to illuminate that gigantic set, far more illumination than usual. You can imagine what a a broiling experience it would have been under those lights and in that heavy mask. But he said, I didn't cry at the audition. I thought it was great fun, and that's why I got the part. And he said, because I was the youngest of seven kids. And he says, I got sort of banged around and kicked around a lot and just learned to be happy about it and didn't complain. And that's why they chose me, because I didn't cry when they put the big heavy rubber head over me. And he said, I had a great time doing it. He said, I remember sitting on Oliver Hardy's lap between takes, and he was reading to me. And he says, and at the end of filming, they gave me a fire engine, a little fire engine that you sit in and work with the pedals. And he said, and they gave me a great big Mother Goose book. So those were my presents from the crew for working well on the film. So he still retains happy memories of working on Babes in Toyland. He didn't have any try. And of course, the pigs encounter the bogeymen too, up close and personal. So he didn't have any trauma with the bogeymen. But it was a point of concern whether that was justified or not.
Pig! Get me a nice, red, juicy apple. I'll steal one of the three little pigs. And the evidence will be placed in Tom Tom's house. You know the penalty for kidnapping? Banishment to Bogeyland!
I always think that the bogeymen... I don't know if you've ever seen Island of Lost Souls with Charles Laughton and Bela Lugosi, but it involves this doctor who's making these strange half-human, half-animal creatures. And there's a variety of different grotesque makeups, which this is 2 years before Babes in Toyland. And every time I see that, I think, I wonder if that wasn't the inspiration for what the bogeymen look like, because there's quite a similarity to them. And in fact, Johnny George, who plays Barnaby's henchman, you know, Master, why the sausage? he played one of the creatures in Island of Lost Souls. Now, we don't know which one, because they're so fully made up, you can't really tell. And whether he might have done double duty, he might have been one of the bogeymen in Babes in Toyland, too. But anyway, so he is in both of those films. And I suspect that maybe somebody saw that and that was an inspiration for what the bogeymen looked like. Henry Brandon told me that he took one home, one of the big rubber masks for the bogeymen, and he used it for years as a Halloween decoration until it finally just crumbled and disintegrated. But he had it for many years.
That's fantastic. Well, of all of the gruesome things that could be in Babes in Toyland, one of the things that freaks me out the most is when Stan starts eating raw sausage.
Oh. Well,
no, don't do that.
People do like steak tartare, don't they? It turns out to be beef, however. So it's not.
That's
it's,
true.
It's not. Pork.
That's true. Yeah, it's raw beef. That's true.
You won't get trichinosis from the beef. And as I say, people do eat steak tartare, which is raw hamburger. So that's it.
Wouldn't
be too appetizing to me, but he eats it nevertheless. So.
Am I right in thinking the film was it didn't really make any profit at the end because of how expensive it was to make?
Well, not only did Stan have the alimony blues, but after he got over that, they got filming for another week or 10 days, and then Stan had an accident whereby he fell off of a raised platform and he tore some ligaments in his right leg. And they thought he would only be gone for a week, and they could shoot around him with the other unit that was filming all of the Charlotte Henry and Felix Knight material. As it turned out, he was gone for 38 days. And not only did that hold up Babes in Toyland, it was holding up other films that Hal Roach still had to make. You know, he was still making shorts with other people. Hal Roach had four stages at that time, and the Babes in Toyland set was taking up two of them that were connected. So, and you couldn't dismantle it and use it for other films. I mean, it was such a lavish, huge set. Where would you put it, number one? So he had half of his studio facilities basically not being able to be used for over a month, for 38 days. And some of the people who were connected with Babes in Toyland had to be kept on the payroll. You couldn't risk losing them going to another studio or to another project when you needed them again. And so, yes, that did mean that the production costs of Babes in Toyland ballooned from an anticipated $250,000 to something like $420,000. So that was a big jump in the cost. And because of that, the film did make a profit, but it was about $14,000 for the Hal Roach Studios, which was about 3 weeks of Stan Laurel's salary. So it broke even and then some, and it was certainly a success d'esteem, as they say, for the Hal Roach Studios, because many of the big reviewers of New York newspapers that normally would disparage Hal Roach Productions as being, you know, silly or low budget or whatever, they gave it rave reviews. And so in a way it did show to MGM that he could make features that were worthy. And so it did prove that to them, but it certainly was not the financial success that The Devil's Brother or Fra Diavolo had been. Devil's Brother cost about $200,000 to make. It wasn't that expensive because most of the costumes were from films that were of that era that had already been made. They just rented them from Western Costume, and it cost $200,000, and it made $1,300,000 worldwide. So that was a very profitable film. Babes in Toyland was not, but it did break even.
Did Variety give it a good review, Randy? Because, you know, they're notorious for...
Yes, Variety, Variety gave it a very good review, and the New York Times and other organs that were usually not all that favorable toward Hal Roach, or specifically Laurel and Hardy movies.
Oh, that's interesting. And you mentioned just briefly that, you know, obviously Roach was still working with his other stars at the at that point. Am I right in thinking that... before the film was made, it was planned to be more of an all-stars vehicle with Charlie Chase and Patsy Kelly and so on?
Yes, there are articles which indicate that the Our Gang kids were going to be in it, and Thelma Todd and Patsy Kelly and all of the people from the Hal Roach stable. And in fact, in Roach's story, Spanky is very prominent. Spanky is part of the framing device, if you will. He and another... one of the kids are urchins, and they're looking longingly into the window of a toy shop. And Laurel and Hardy, who are Simple Simon and the Pie Man, have come into some money, and they take pity on the kids, and they bring the kids to their little shabby apartment, and they begin to tell them the story of Toyland, and that leads us into the body of the film. And then at the end of the film, you see Spanky and the other, his older sister, you know, enthusing about all the wonderful adventures that Laurel and Hardy have told them about, and how happy they are that Laurel and Hardy didn't have to cut off Tom Tom's head. that's one of the last lines in the movie, or in the script that Hal Roach had envisioned. So anyway, yes, Spanky very much so. Nobody specifically in the rest of Roach's script, but there are articles in the trade papers that indicate that other Hal Roach people were going to be spotted in it. And you can see that might well have worked, if you could find appropriate fairy tale characters for other people to play. I don't know how Irvin S. Cobb would have worked, but, but I think Thelma Todd would have worked. Maybe, you know, as Mary Quite Contrary or the Queen of Hearts or somebody.
Yeah. I was surprised to see, I mean, I didn't realize Charlie Rogers was in it until I looked in the book.
Yes, Charlie Rogers on both sides of the camera. He was the director for the Laurel and Hardy scenes, and he plays Simple Simon, which was the role that Roach had envisioned for Stan Laurel. He doesn't have a lot to do. In fact, there was a scene that was in the script and filmed, because there's a still of it in the book, but it didn't make the final cut, where after the wedding, where Barnaby is mistakenly wed to Stanny and not to Bo Peep, Barnaby is running to his house, and he passes by the school, and the school kids are being let out, and they start taunting him for being stood up at the altar. And Simple Simon is there and going, "Hey, you got stood up at the altar, didn't you?" And Barnaby grabs him by the collar and says, "Why, I'll vow vengeance on them for making a fool, for humiliating me." And that was replaced by the scene where he's in his little lair with his assistant, and he says, "Idiot, dolt, imbecile, pig," and gets the idea to kidnap Elmer. In the original story, as the kids were being let out of school, evidently the three little pigs were also classmates of theirs, and so they were coming out of the school as well, and that's where he got the idea in the original script. But they shot it, because there's a still. But it did not make... I looked through the cutting continuity which was at the Motion Picture Academy Library. And that is something that indicates what happens in every shot of the finished film. And so it was a twin to the film that we have today. So there are not, there was always a rumor that there was a scene in the schoolroom where kids were singing, "Put down six and carry two, da, da, da." It's a song called "I Can't Do the Sum." And Gene Darling remembered filming it. And, you know, other people said, "Oh, yeah, I was in the classroom sequences." Well, maybe they filmed it. I've never seen any stills from it outside of this one still where the kids are outside the school. There's nothing in the script that indicates that there was such a scene. And there's nothing in the cutting continuity that indicates that it was ever in the film. So it could well have been, but didn't make the final cut.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. So through taking the deeper dive, if let's say into the film, did anything come out that really surprised you? That really sort of stayed with you from that process?
Well, Roach's involvement in it, because as I say, when I interviewed him in 1981, he said, you know, I was out of the thing entirely, and I took him at his word, but. Now, having access to all of the day-by-day trade papers, you realize, you know, Roach auditions Felix Knight. Roach is thinking of Patricia Ellis for the Mary Quite Contrary. Roach this, Roach that. So he was very much involved at every point. And you can imagine a film that was being financed by MGM to the tune of $250,000. He wasn't going to just sit idly by and let that be produced without any input from him. So that, yes, that did surprise me, the extent of his involvement, given the fact that he so disparaged the film later on, which is sad. You know, you would think he was rightly applauded by many of the trade papers in the reviews. They're saying, you know, congratulations to Hal Roach for producing this wonderful film, da, da, da. And rightly so, because he was very much involved in it. So it's perplexing, especially because he said over and over, and I have him saying this on tape, that 50% of what's in the script will not play. Just assume that what you write will sound very funny on paper, but when you get it up on the stage, it won't be as funny as you thought it was, and you better have somebody there to come up with something better, because you can assume that 50% will not play. Well, for someone who came up with so many of the really good Laurel and Hardy storylines, why he would continue for 60 years to continue to be attached to this one story, which wasn't very good. That just perplexes me. And like I say, in June of 1980, he came up with a treatment for something called Toyland, which was a little bit more modern, but it was essentially the same story as he had in 1933. And it was still just as grim and just as devoid of comedy. So, so it's one of the great mysteries. But anyway,
in fact, that's a question that I had from one of our patrons, Kevin Kusinitz. He asked about that. He said he wanted to let you know that he read the book this week. He's found it really interesting.
Good.
Especially how Hal Roach wrote a new treatment for the story in 1980.
Yes,
he thinks. If you have a chance, can you ask Randy if Roach really thought he could make a new version, or did he do it just for his own pleasure?
I think he was always looking to get back into production. Craig Coleman talks about working with him on scripts in the later 80s, you know, 1988, 89. You know, he was always a person who was thinking about what am I going to do today and tomorrow? He really, it's surprising that he made himself so accessible to people like me who wanted to talk about what he had done, you know, 65 years earlier. but which he did, because he lived right across the street from UCLA. And on both occasions when I interviewed him, the first thing he said was, "You have exactly 1 hour." And he had to do that because when I was sitting waiting to be admitted into his study, out came a college-age film student with a cassette player and some notes under his arm. Then I came in with my cassette player and notes under my arm. And when my hour was done, I came out, and there was another college student with cassette player and notes under his arm waiting to be admitted. So I got the both times. So I got the impression that many days of the week, he was seeing an army of UCLA film students probably responding to the same questions over and over and over again. You know, how did Laurel and Hardy get together? How do you get the Argan kids, et cetera, et cetera? I think Mr. Roach liked me, and why I got invited back for a second interview was because I'd gone through every printed interview I could find with him and said, okay, I already have an answer for this. I'm only going to ask him questions that I don't have answered in print. And so I was asking him things like, we know that Stan Laurel's first five films for you were made in 1918, and they were meant to finish off a series from Toto, who could not finish them. Why couldn't Toto finish the series? And when I said that to him, he brightened up and he ran to a picture on his wall and he said, here, this is Toto here. And so the fact that I was asking him questions that were sort of out of left field, I think he appreciated that, not having to answer the same things over and over again. So
yeah.
Anyway,
I can imagine that.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Oh, Randy, that's fantastic. I mean, you probably need a breather. I'm going to take this opportunity just to flash this in front of everybody again. So if you haven't yet got your copy of March of the Wooden Soldiers, it's available on Amazon, anywhere else?
Amazon, all over the world, and primarily for because of postage, primarily for people in the USA, you can get it from bonaventurepress.com, B-O-N-A-V-E-N-T-U-R-E, Bonaventure Press. If you want me to sign it and personalize it, I will do that for you. For people who are in other countries who want me to sign or personalize it, it's really kind of hard to do it on the actual book, but I would be happy to sign a card for you and send it to you, which you can put in the book. So I can do that. That's the next best thing. But unfortunately, postage from Southern California to the UK is about $75, which is more than what the book costs. And I'm sorry that the postage is so exorbitant, but that's sending a postcard is much less expensive. So maybe that's the way to go. But it is available, and I'm seeing that people around the world. I had Facebook messages yesterday from someone in Berlin and someone in Amsterdam. So it's going around the world. And you have your copy in the UK. So it's getting all over Europe. And I had a message yesterday from someone in Wisconsin who had his, and I got mine this morning. So happy to see that it's a real book.
It exists.
Has about 400 photographs in it. Oh yes, we have a photo gallery because there were so many nice portraits of the different people. I just said, well, what other venue am I going to have to use those? Let's just do a little portrait gallery and make sure that those get in. And there you right there, you were at that article from a British film magazine. Lady named Dorothy Hope came and visited the set, and she did this wonderful, vivid account of what it was like to be on the set and then also to be entertained by Stan and Ruth at their home on Glenbar Street in Cheviot Hills, which I thought was great. It gave you a lot of human interest insight into being on the set and what Stan Laurel was like off camera. So I ran that in full because I just thought it gave you so much insight in a relatively brief amount of time. So by the way, I do cover subsequent productions of Babes in Toyland. I mean, this film had a life of its own after it left the Hal Roach Studios, because 10 years after the production of it, the rights went to Victor Herbert's estate, mainly Ella Herbert Bartlett. And she hated this film, which is why it was retitled, because she thought that her father's masterwork was Babes in Toyland, the stage production, and she didn't want it to be tarnished by this travesty done by Laurel and Hardy. And so when she subsequently licensed it to other distributors, it was always with the proviso that you not call it Babes in Toyland. And that's also why they always cut the beginning of it, where you see Virginia Carnes as Mother Goose in front of the big book that says Babes in Toyland. There were some prints that just omitted that part and went into a further part of the Toyland opening number. And most prints, which are the ones that I saw all the time I was a kid, just omitted that whole prologue entirely. And they just opened with the gates of Toyland and the tracking or the crane shot of the big panorama of Toyland. So that whole introduction where the people are introduced in the pages of the storybook, that was gone from the prints that I saw. And then subsequently, and I don't know why this wasn't a concern in 1934 with the production code people, but in the Go to Sleep, Slumber Deep, Tom Tom and Bo Peep sleep next to each other, but they're not married. And that didn't bother anybody in 1934, but evidently it did in 1950, because when it was resubmitted for approval, they said, no, I got to cut that. They're not married. They can't sleep next to each other. So that's why they cut Go to Sleep, Slumber Deep. So in most of the prints that I saw, two of the five major musical numbers were missing. So it was not that much of a musical when I was a kid, because they cut 6 minutes of music out of the film. Yeah.
I used to wish they did that with the Marx Brothers films. Just cut them out, just speed them on.
Well, yes, we don't need the water ballet in Day at the Races. That's right. But anyway, this film has an amazing after story, because it was a number of different rights were held by a number of different distributors, one of whom was a producer by the name of Boris Morris, who you may know from The Flying Deuces. Well, 10 years after The Flying Deuces, he and his partner, William LeBaron, who's the guy who didn't make Babes in Toyland in 1930 with Wheeler and Woolsey, they were collaborating on trying again to make another new Babes in Toyland in Technicolor, with the George Pal Puppetoons in it, and with Dennis Day and Ezio Pinza, who subsequently went on to do South Pacific. They were going to be in the cast, and it was going to be a $3 million production. And of course, as often happens with things that are announced in the trade papers, nothing ever came of it. But they did, in order to keep the old Babes in Toyland from being distributed, they bought it lock, stock, and barrel from Hal Roach for $3,000. That was a shocker to me. They bought the negative and everything else, any other rights that Hal Roach might have had in it. They bought it. They not only made a deal with the Victor Herbert estate for $66,000 for the filming rights, but they bought whatever Hal Roach had, and Roach sold it to, you know, that's practically giving it away, Colonel. $3,000 for the negative and everything else that Roach might have had in it. So they owned it for a while, but then they had to default on a loan. And so that all became part of the finance company that had given them the loan. So it's a very tangled web. And suffice it to say, it is described in excruciating detail in the book. And you can find out who owned what at any given time. But in the States, at least, it is now owned by WPIX New York. And that station has, with the exception of a few years, has run that film at Thanksgiving time in late November and at Christmas time for 60 years. And it really has a very special and devoted audience in New York City, more so than in other parts of the country. It really is a big tradition in New York. And I wanted to make sure that was noted especially. And so I appealed to people I know on Facebook, if you're from New York and if this was a tradition to you, tell me of your memories of it. And people wrote back with great, wonderful, colorful stories of how this signified the start of the holiday season for them. And, you know, how special it was and remains, because they still run it. So anyway, and there were many years when it really was not available anywhere else. You know, I can't remember the first time I saw it, but I do remember being very excited around 1974 when a little company called Thunderbird Films made it available in Super 8 sound, which was what I was collecting in those days. Like, oh boy, I got to get that one. Wow. So they kind of kept it alive in the culture for many years. And so I thought that they should be especially saluted for doing that. So that's part of the after story. And then there were several productions done for television and even a couple of theatrical films, or at least one theatrical film, of it. And once again, every time they do it, they rewrite the story. But the only thing you can count on is it will have the song Toyland and the March of the Toys. Those two songs always survive, and Barnaby. Those are the three things that are in every production. Otherwise, it's anybody's game.
As long as there's been a murder involved, well, that's okay. Yeah. We don't mind that. Murdering children,
no,
we love that.
No, we don't. That's only 1902.
That's fascinating, Randy. Absolutely superb. I'm going to ask four questions in a second.
All right.
Before I do that, I've got a couple in the chat. I think some of these guys might have uh, no microphone. So Kevin says that, in fact, this is just talking about the New York link. Kevin says, thanks for all you do to keep the memory of the boys alive. I grew up in Queens, New York. As you mentioned, March of the Wooden Soldiers was and still is a Thanksgiving holiday tradition on WPIX Channel 11. If you're looking to purchase a copy of the film today, what is the best available version? And for the future, what are the best film elements that still exist? Any chance of an ultimate restored version?
Well, the best one, and there are still lots of used copies, is this one, which was put out in 2009, looks like. And it was done by Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer and 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment. This is the, it is absolutely complete. Even though it says March of the Wooden Soldiers, the main title on what you will see says Babes in Toyland. And it even has the production code seal at the beginning of it. It was located at the George Eastman House Archive in New York, in Rochester, New York, by Ray Fiola, who is a particular fan of this film. And he did us all a favor by finding that element, which is the best one that is known to survive. I don't know if it's still in the same pristine shape it was in then, because, you know, it is nitrate film, and nitrate film will ultimately decompose. But that's the best one.
Kevin, who asked the question, said he actually belongs to the Themnar Hills tent that Ray Fiola runs.
Very
in
good.
Ellenville,
well, thank
New York.
Tell Ray hi and thanks again for me. He was very helpful in this project.
That's great. And the last question in the chat I have is from Michael Thomas. Michael says, I'm a huge fan of both the podcast and Randy's books. Thanks to you both for all you do to keep the legacy of Laurel and Hardy alive. My question is, are there any colour reference photos of the Babes in Toyland production set or costumes? Curious how accurate the colourised version might be.
Yeah, you know, people wondered if this would be made in colour. In fact, that was a question that MGM floated right as soon as Roach bought the rights. They were saying, you know, could we possibly do this in colour? And Roach thought about it, and Roach had actually just at that time made a deal with the Technicolor people, primarily Herbert Kalmus, to use the two-color system, which if you've seen, primarily registers orange and green. He was going to make some more gang shorts in color. I suspect the reason why he was able to make a deal for that system was because it was just about to become obsolete, because right at the time that Babes in Toyland was going into production, Warner Brothers made a couple of two-reel comedy shorts with Leon Errol called Good Morning Eve and Service with a Smile, which are the first movies made in theatrically live-action movies in three-strip Technicolor, which became the standard for many years. And so that captured the whole array of color, not just orange and green. And so the old system was immediately obsolete. And had they done Babes in Toyland in two color, I suspect we would probably prefer seeing it in black and white rather than orange and green.
Yes.
So the idea was floated of doing it in color. However, the color film stock was very slow, and it had to go, I believe you had two strips of film going through the same aperture in that camera, which made it further slow. And you already had this gigantic set, which needed much, much more illumination than usual, because it's so wide and so tall. You know, it's not the same thing as just Laurel and Hardy in their apartment, a little apartment set. It's a lot of lights. And to then further burden it with color, I don't even know if it was technically feasible to do it in color. It's too bad that we don't have any color photos of it, as far as I know, because both Henry Brandon and Stan Laurel in letters, you can see on Letters from Stan, the website that Bernie Hoje does, Henry Brandon said, oh, it was just so amazing to walk on that set every day because it was painted in color. It was painted in color like these beautiful colors you see in children's storybooks. So like sometimes happens with movies that are made in black and white where they painted in what looked to be not very appealing colors simply because they will register well in black and white, we're painted in full color. And Roach at one point wanted to donate the sets to the city of Los Angeles as a children's playground. But they said, well, these sets are not built to withstand the elements very long, and it would take us a lot of time and a lot of money to transport these to Griffith Park. So thank you, but no thank you. So they were dismantled, but you know, I was very happy. Rich Finnegan, almost when I was wrapping everything up, came in at the last moment with a couple of stills I've never seen before, and I don't know if anybody else has. Thelma Todd had a niece named Shirley who came for a visit from back east. She came to Hollywood to visit her Auntie Thelma. And as a result, there were pictures of pretty much just the shoe all by itself. You got to see a really good shot of the old woman's shoe. And also there's a cup and a saucer. And there's a picture of little Shirley sitting on the lip of the saucer. So I was trying to find stills of just the sets so that we could really see them. Because, you know, I mean, as well it should, the camera never really parks and says, look at these beautiful sets. It's more concerned about just telling you the story, and you only see what you see of the sets as it pertains to the action. There's really a whole other side of the Toyland set that you don't really get to see very much. you know, you see the school room with the pencils as the supports, and you see the toy factory, and you see the old woman's shoe, and you see Barnaby's decrepit old house. But that's only on one side of the Toyland structure. The other side, there's a jack-in-the-box, and there's a cup and saucer and all sorts of other things that really don't get seen very much in the movie. So I was trying to find stills of just the sets, and there may be some out there that I haven't found yet. But, you know, we have what we have.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, guys, I'm going to invite questions from the patrons, if anybody has one.
Say, aren't you going to ask?
I can't ask him now. Don't you see what a bad humor he's in? If I ask him now, he'd jump right down my throat.
Well, I thought you and he were just like that.
We are.
Well, why don't you ask him?
Why don't you ask him?
Well, I can't ask him.
Why?
Well, he and I are just like that.
Oh, don't be silly. He likes you better than he does me.
Does he?
Yeah. He told me he did.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, Master. Ollie wants to speak to you.
Chris, we'll start with Chris. Can you unmute yourself, Chris?
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Go for it.
Thank you, Randy. That was more interesting than I can say. I have a two-part question. Forgive me if you did reference this, but I was wondering what kind of prompted the writing of this book. What was the inspiration to start, you know, this movie as opposed to any other movie? And also what's your if you're not ready to take a big vacation from this, what's your next project is going to be?
Well, it as I say, it was a particularly dramatic production behind the scenes because of Stan's alimony blues and then hurting his leg. And there were many other illnesses and injuries that kept putting roadblocks in this film being produced. And this was sort of a make or break movie for Hal Roach. So it was a dramatic story in and of itself in the production. It had a dramatic story after it was released. And I had lots of great material with people who worked on it. So it lent itself to that. And also, again, that WPIX audience in New York has been very faithful to this movie for 60 years. And I thought that was another reason why this film specifically needed a book. As to my next project, well, I have, this probably is not much of interest to people outside of America, but my friend Jordan Young and I, Jordan published the first edition of Magic Behind the Movies. And he and I, many years ago, interviewed all sorts of people who worked in radio drama and comedy. They're all gone now, but we got all sorts of interviews with people who were actors and sound effects men and musicians and producers and writers. And so I really want to get those transcribed and get into print because they all had fascinating stories about, you know, just as silent movies are a medium that America threw away, well, radio drama is another one that we threw away. And just as silent movies are an entirely different experience from talkies, radio drama is an entirely different experience from television. And, you know, I'm glad that it survived in England, but it should have survived here, too. And so anyway, that's something that I really want to get done just because we put it off for 30 years. So it's time to get that done before we both go. So that's probably going to be the next thing.
Brilliant. Thanks, Chris. Anybody else with a question?
Hi, Stephen.
Stephen.
Hello.
Yeah, go for Stephen.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hello from the Babes in Toyland tent in St. Louis, Missouri. Yeah, nice. Thank you, Patrick, for this opportunity. My question is kind of Babes in Toyland adjacent. I'm a fan of Stan and Babe, obviously, but also Walt Disney. I've just got my copy, the soft version. Good. I'm waiting for the hardcover sign that my wife has given me for Christmas.
Okay,
that I know about.
Well, we're waiting for them to show up at the doorstep of Bonaventure Press, but as soon as we get them, you'll get them.
Well, we also got this one signed, so thank you so much.
Oh, good.
For
okay.
That. I love the connection with Walt Disney that you talked about, that he had so much to do now. He knew Hal Roach and his connection with Babes in Toyland. I briefly also loved how you described how Stan and the gag men would work out some of the gags in the projection room, mm-hmm. and reminded me how Walt would act out scenes and whole movies for his animators to convey what his vision was. And mm-hmm. I just love that parallel. And forgive me, I haven't read it all yet, but you may have covered it in the book.
Took me 4 years to write it, so you can have a couple of days to read it.
Right? What do we know about Hal Roach's relationship with Walt Disney? And for that matter, do we know anything about any interactions or friendships with Stan or Babe with Walt Disney?
Well, Roach and Disney, as I say, were buddies. They were polo buddies at the Uplifters Club, which was a compound started in the late teens. I think L. Frank Baum actually was one of the key people starting it. It was for well-to-do people, men, in Los Angeles. During Prohibition days, it was a way where they could sneak off and drink. So a lot of the people who were law enforcement people who should have been keeping people from getting booze were secretly getting their own at the Uplifters Club. It was named the Uplifters Club not only for the uplifting of the spirit, but also for the uplifting of the elbow when one was in his cups. But they had a big sports compound there. And part of it was a polo grounds, and they had, you can see it in Wrong Again, the stables at Wrong Again, where Laurel and Hardy work in the beginning of the film, or at the Uplifters Club, which was in Pacific Palisades. And I don't know what is there now, but anyway, it was the recreation place and the place to get away from Prohibition officers and wives in the 20s and early 30s. And Roach and Disney played polo along with Will Rogers and other Hollywood luminaries. And so that's how they got to know each other. Of course, they were both independent producers, making short subjects and releasing through major studios. So they had that parallel and probably talked about that, you know, having to deal with the big boys who were financing things while they had their own little studio. Too bad Roach didn't have the merchandising that Walt Disney did. I have a still of Laurel and Hardy with Kay Kamen on the set of Pardon Us. Kay Kamen was the guy who came to Disney and said, you know, you can make a fortune by licensing Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and everybody else for toy manufacturers and watch manufacturers and whatever, and I'll handle that for you. And Disney said, oh, okay, good idea. Well, that's what kept Disney afloat. You know, he lost money on every cartoon he ever made because they were so lavish, but what kept him afloat was all the money coming in from all the toys and dolls. So too bad that Roach didn't have Kay Kamen come in and do the same thing. You know, you could have your own very Charlie Chase doll, for crying out loud. Probably say, I need a drink. Anyway, I would imagine that Roach and Disney maintained a cordial relationship. I don't know how close it was. But Roach was a member of every social organization in Los Angeles and, you know, was a master at networking. So that's how a lot of people wound up at the studio. And of course, Roach and Stan Laurel were still alive when Disney made his 1961 film. And as you know, Henry Calvin and Gene Sheldon are very Laurel and Hardy-ish characters, as was noted in several of the reviews for the Disney Babes in Toyland. And as was noted rather despairingly by Mel Levin, who co-wrote the script for the 61 Babes in Toyland. He didn't like the idea that they were really so closely resembling Laurel and Hardy. So anyway, I don't know the extent of their later relationship, but they were close in the 1930s.
That's interesting. I'm pretty sure this is probably in your book, because obviously Stan and Babe appear in a number of Walt Disney cartoons, don't they? Was that some sort of reciprocal, you can use our, you know?
Well, yeah. Well, they show up in all sorts of cartoons. I just saw them in a Warner Brothers called, anyway, it was basically a reworking of the Shoemaker and the Elves. And it was done by Friz Freleng, and two of the elves were Laurel and Hardy. So that was one that I hadn't seen before, and I just saw that for the first time last week. In fact, there is a book out there about Laurel and Hardy appearing in animated cartoons.
Yes.
Allie Stevenson, yes. The Mitchell Waits did that, did they?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hang on. Here it is.
There, the animated antics, yes. So, there you go, right there. That's from Mother Goose Goes Hollywood, where Stan is the pieman, or Simple Simon, and Ollie is the pieman. And those are the roles that Roach envisioned for them in his story of Babes in Toyland. So whether Disney ever read that story or not, I don't know. But great minds think alike. And Disney, too, had the idea that it would work well for them to be Simple Simon and the pieman. And Roach asked Disney for permission to use the Three Little Pigs, which he didn't really have to do because that goes back to English children's stories of the late 1800s. So that was not an original Disney concept, but he wanted to use the Three Little Pigs as people knew them from the Silly Symphony cartoon of the year before, 1933. And he also wanted to use Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf, which was written specifically for the Disney cartoon. And Disney's letter to Roach, giving him full permission, and not only that, but whatever else you want, it survives. And I quote it in full in the book, and you actually get to see the letter itself. So their cordial off-screen relationship had a beneficial effect for Roach, because Disney was more than accommodating. It's not, you know, not only will I give you permission to use the Three Little Pigs, but if you want the voices of the girls who did their voices in the cartoon, we'll get them for you, and whatever else you want. I never did find anything specific to Mickey Mouse, but I presume there was other correspondence where Disney said, you know, sure, go ahead. And by the way, Mickey Mouse is played mostly by a capuchin monkey, because Tony Campanero, who was the animal trainer for Roach, before he worked at Roach's, he was an actual organ grinder, an Italian organ grinder with a little monkey that would go and take your penny for people who were listening to the organ grinding music. Although I suspect that in the scenes where Mickey is in the dirigible, the little Zeppelin, and he's throwing the darts at the bogeyman, I suspect that there's one of the kids who played the Three Little Pigs probably in the Mickey outfit there, because he has to have the manual dexterity to pick up the darts and throw them, which I don't think a monkey would have. So I think they built the Zeppelin a little bigger so that Mickey would still appear small and match the shots of the monkey. But I'm sure it's a kid in there that's throwing the darts at the bogeyman.
I'm just flicking through. Was it Holiday for Shoestrings?
Yes, that's it. That's it.
There you go.
Holiday for Shoestrings. I couldn't think of the title. That's it. Boys. Yep, there they are as two of the Shoemaker's elves.
There we go.
Here's Freeling. Oh, looks like Russ has a question. Or he's saying stop.
Russ has a question. Oh, here we go. Come on then, Russ. Let's see you.
Hi, everybody. I wonder, Randy, sometimes many years ago I heard the story about Stan not wanting to put the derbies on.
Yeah.
You're saying it might be an excuse. I think there's a deep connection, I think, with Stan, with pantomime, that goes back a long way for him and for people in Britain, because when we see Babes in Toyland, it has a deep resonation to what we would go and see at Christmas time mm-hmm. on the stage and stuff. And I just wonder whether he must have thought, this story is rubbish. You know, I think he probably did mean that. Yeah. He probably was a bit of an...
It is rubbish. I'm sorry. I hate to be so blunt, but you're right. It just doesn't work.
Rubbish. I just wonder what sort of connections you can see or think you might have with this sort of pantomime history.
Well, you know, his first professional engagement was in a company of Sleeping Beauty.
Exactly. That's what exactly
when he was 17, his dad got him, I've seen the contract, with Levy and Cardwell, a pantomime company. And Stan was a big overstuffed doll called a Gollywog. And I don't think he had any lines, but he was in a Christmas pantomime type of play. And the other way where this comes into play for Babes in Toyland was I think that Glenn McDonough, when he wrote the original script for the 1903 stage production, there was a very grim short story about the toy maker, and there's that. So there's that element, but he drew a lot of it also from Babes in the Wood, which goes back centuries, goes back to like the 1500s. And there are many different editions of the story, but a lot of it has to do with their nasty uncle who wants to kill them because of an inheritance. Well, there you have that in Glenn McDonough's story. And it, in Stan Laurel's time, it was usually done as a riotous burlesque comedy. And you would have the pantomime dame, usually a very tall, overweight man, in drag as the pantomime dame, which is how it was produced in Stan Laurel's time. Yes. So
So if
Stan saw it when he was 10 or 11, that's likely the type of production he would have seen of it. So yes, Christmas pantomimes, obviously a big tradition, and Babes in Toyland pretty much following in that tradition. In fact, the last thing Henry Brandon did was a production called The Old Man of the Sea, not And the Sea, but Of the Sea. And he played this undersea creature. He was in a full body stocking, a bright green, bedecked with seaweed. And he was the bad guy, of course. And he was, you know, snarling at a very big performance. And it was only about a month before he died. I wonder if maybe he put a little too much of himself into that performance because he had a heart attack and died about a month after that. But that was produced and probably written by Tony Hawes, who was married to Stan Laurel's daughter, Lois. And it was produced where we still have the Way Out West meetings at the Mayflower Club in North Hollywood. But so that was Henry's last performance, as far as I know. But it was very much a Christmas pantomime type of thing.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
Anybody else with a question? Karen.
Hello.
Hi. This isn't really a question, but I have a little more to add about the nitrate print.
Uh-huh.
That's at George Eastman Museum. I got to see that projected, I think it was 2006, at a special event.
Oh, wow.
People got to see that, were very impressed because it had all the parts that they never remembered never getting to see on television.
Uh-huh.
But then when the Nitrate Picture Show event started, which was 2015, that's now a yearly weekend festival of showing nitrate prints.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding is that print is now too shrunken to be projected again.
Yeah, that's what I understand. So
it still exists there. But then they also have a 35 millimeter safety print, which they've shown occasionally, and I was able to introduce it one time.
Oh, good, good. Well, you know, even when the prints have shrunk, they do have special machines now where when they do the 4K scanning, they don't run it through a projector. It's on a flat surface, and they can accommodate the shrinkage. So there have been films like that have started to shrink a bit, but they've still been able to rescue it. So maybe they could still do something with it, because I understand that the 16 millimeter print of the second reel of Battle of the Century has now started to go vinegar syndrome, which of course means that it's also shrinking and curling and becoming unprojectable. But happily, they have other ways of saving the image, even if you can't run it through a projector anymore. So, you know, thank you for that information.
Yeah, thank you, Karen. Fantastic.
I've got a very important question I want to ask you.
Don't bother me now. Can't you see that I'm busy? Go on with your work.
Well, if you knew how important it was, you'd see me privately, because if
you... shut up and go on with your work!
It looks like everybody has put their questions to Randy. Randy,
I've exhausted them all.
Not at all. I'm sure you've exhausted yourself. You must need to lie down after all that. That's fantastic stuff. Randy, thank you so much for spending time with us today. It's been brilliant to spend this time with you. It's always brilliant to listen to you.
Thank you and, for the opportunity. I appreciate it very, very much.
Not at all. And I will quickly put that up in front of everybody again.
It does exist.
March of the Wooden Soldiers. It does exist in hardback.
Yes, paper and hard. Yes, both.
There we go. I mean, hopefully it won't be too long before we see you again or hear you again for most of them. Because, of course, we're at the talkies now, of course, unaccustomed as we are. I do have some plans for that.
Oh,
I've got a number of names lined up that I'm hoping I can bring in.
Well, I hope I'm one of them.
Yes, you are. Funnily enough, yes, you are.
Yes, okay. Let me know when you want me to write something else for the Laurel and Hardy magazine, which everybody should subscribe to.
Oh, yes. Yes, good call.
I'm waiting for mine anxiously.
Yeah, so we're definitely, unaccustomed as we are, we'll have you back on for that, Randy. That'll be amazing. Okay. Really looking forward to that one.
I have the recording ledgers somewhere for Unaccustomed as We Are, which are quite interesting.
Oh, okay. Great stuff.
Yeah, that was recorded in a way unlike any of the other, and shot in a way unlike any of the other pictures. So
right,
we'll keep that in abeyance as a cliffhanger and an appetizer for the episode to come.
Fantastic. Okay, right. So thank you very much indeed, Randy. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful.
And good wishes and happy Christmas and a wonderful New Year to everybody who is online and anybody who else might subsequently listen to this. Best wishes for 2024 and God bless us, everyone.
I just want to wish you all a very Merry Christmas. It's been great to finally see some of you, and hopefully we can do this again in the very near future. It's been a blast.
All right.
Merry Christmas
to everybody, and to all a good night.
Yes.